Good afternoon. Seeds contain within them the promise of new life. From the earliest days of genetics, the inner transformations of the seed, efforts to control genes and to alter heredity, have paralleled outward efforts in agriculture. This has remade our landscapes and our worlds and expanded our technosphere. As the Nobel Prize-winning American geneticist H.J. Muller announced in 1947, we cannot make life, far from it. Probably we can, however, remake it. We must not shrink from our destiny or fear it, he said. We must work in functional alliance with our genes so that evolution will become, for the first time, a conscious process. That will be, he wrote, the highest freedom that man or life can have, the highest form of freedom. Muller's mid-century hopes that evolution might finally be brought under human control closely mirrored the actual achievements of the so-called Green Revolution, that period from 1946 to 1966, when crop production more than doubled in Mexico, in China, in South Asia, and in other parts of the developing world, averting famines that are said to otherwise have ensued from rapid population growth. And indeed, the pure science of genetics and the applied science of agriculture have long been associated with each other. So seeds are fertile fields for thinking about life and its biotechnological possibilities. Today, treating and designing living things and thinking of them as technology platforms, our visions might include biofuels or pharmaceuticals. But over a century ago, efforts to understand and to control heredity developed hand in hand with the development of new fruits, flowers, and crops. The biological avant-garde has never been far from the avant-garden. The prospect of bringing evolution under human control was an enticing one for breeders and horticulturalists and geneticists alike at the turn of the 20th century. The dawn of a new mutation theory around 1900 brought these ideas of experimental evolution to the forefront in ways that might have commercial benefit, it was hoped. Researchers working in places like Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York, which is still a major laboratory for molecular biology today, thought that they could hurry up evolution, that there would be a way that they could help the farmer to mold, they said, the animal and vegetable kingdoms to best suit his commercial interests, rather than to wait for nature to take its course. Creatures that a previous generation might have dismissed as monsters could now be carefully studied as mutants, in the hope that they would lead to, as one newspaper at the time put it, the modification and improvement of animals and plants at man's will. Although many had tried and failed to find a means of producing new mutants at will, the new discovery of radioactivity and of X-rays gave fresh hope. And it was in 1927 that Muller himself made a major discovery. In the course of a relatively simple experiment, zapping fruit flies with X-rays, he found that he had been able to increase the mutation rate and create hundreds of new mutants that had never been seen before. As many, he said, as had previously been found in the whole 20-year history of fly study, in which dozens of investigators had examined over 25 million flies. This was, he said, the promised land of mutations, where all types of mutations, large and small, ugly and beautiful, burst upon the gaze. They were a motley throng, he said. The roots of life, the genes, had indeed been struck and had yielded, he said. Muller's triumphal achievement, which he called the artificial transmutation of the gene in his landmark paper in the journal Science, spread far and wide and was said to have opened a new epoch of genetical research. And it was from mutant flies like these that geneticists began to understand the secrets of the gene, the relationship of genes to chromosomes, and the stuff of life itself, the seeds within seeds. Muller ultimately received the Nobel Prize for this work, his pathbreaking work in radiation, but many years later, in 1946. This is the year after the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and on Nagasaki, and therefore not coincidentally a time when many people were concerned about the effects of ionizing radiation on health, human or otherwise, and on heredity as well. Indeed, Muller's increasing concern over the years led him to consider mutation more of a threat to public health than the promise of a better future. Already envisioning the dangers of an increasingly radioactive Cold War world, in 1948, he called for mutational prophylaxis, a decrease in our overall exposure to radiation, whether from bombs or from medicine. But in 1948, a natural mutagenic process was also discovered, when Barbara McClintock succeeded in accomplishing with the genome itself what Muller had been using ionizing radiation to do. So McClintock had set up particular crosses that she had made in maize. Particular crosses where the chromosomes themselves would manage to tear each other apart, the things that radiation had previously done, and the chromosomes would then rearrange and rejoin in complex and interesting ways, but with no radiation required at all. Nature could be its own disruptor, its own designer. And it was in 1948, after 15 years of work on this, that she managed to confirm the existence of what she called mutable loci in maize, or what would later be called jumping genes, or also transposons. So this report that McClintock wrote in 1948, published in the annual report of the director of the Department of Genetics at Cold Spring Harbor, that same place I had mentioned, is where she had first produced this report for public consumption here, this mutable loci in maize. Let you take a look at it there. So a colleague who shared this with me said that reading her papers, which are incredibly dense, is a bit like reading mathematics, but upside down and backwards and in a foreign language. So very dense and complicated work that she managed to do. As an expert in cytogenetics, she had been used to looking through microscopes. This was her standard form of being able to learn things, right? To see what was going on with the chromosomes in the cells. But the effects of the changes that she was studying were sometimes also visible to the naked eye. I'll put some of these up here so you can take a look a little bit closer of some of the kinds of things that she was interested in. We're very lucky to have these samples here that I can show you that you can take a closer look at. And the ones that would not have made it across the border, I'll put on the screen up here for you to take a look at. So some of these kernels have sectors or dots or stripes and very interesting patterns that she learned how to read very carefully by telling exactly what was going on in each of these kernels. It was a remarkable skill that she developed that came from a very long time of studying these in great detail here. She found kernels that had sectors or stripes or dots that were split in half. On the image above, you can see some kernels that are exactly half, and that this was basically a way that she could trace through pigment the cell lineages in the kernels. She learned how to read them, these stripes, and she said it looked like this cell gained what the other cell had lost. I couldn't get it out of my head, she said. An extraordinary thing happened. It had gone wild. The genome had gone wild. So not only had McClintock found many more mutations than she had ever expected, but she discovered something even stranger through her studies, that it was particular genes that appeared to be causing this breakage and that these streaks were then evidence of this transposition and that these genes were dynamic, that they hopped from place to place in the chromosomes from one to another and from parents to progeny. People have said how pleased I must be, she said, that all this transposition is going on. And I said, don't take that for granted. The real point is control. The real secret of all of this is control. And she even called her jumping genes controllable elements. So McClintock believed that she had broken the gene regulation system, that she had thrown it all out of kilter, and so that all these spontaneous bursts of hundreds of mutations that she began to see were the result of mobile elements that were silencing the genes that they landed in or near. And so rather than having discovered jumping genes alone, which other people had also been noticing, she held that she had discovered a new system of gene regulation, a way of turning genes on and off, part of what today we might consider under the category of epigenetics. And she spent the next 30 years trying to figure out exactly how this system worked. So while Muller had begun by focusing on genes and discovered these untold rates of mutations in fruit flies, McClintock began by manipulating chromosomes and ended up discovering these untold genetic mechanisms of expression. A few years later, from 1957 to 1966, McClintock began to work with associates in Mexico. This is the ancestral home of maize, of course, and she was there on a project to trace the evolutionary origin of maize and the complex history of plant and human associations. and this work had paralleled a larger effort at the time to develop new seeds for local distribution to farmers. So once again, genetical and agricultural interests were never far apart. As part of a committee for the preservation of indigenous strains of maize, McClintock began to understand how these different chromosome combinations, she said, could produce the most extraordinary plants and ones that don't look anything at all like maize. I began to realize, she said, that any genome can make practically any other. Everything is ready for it. There were all the same kinds of basic things, she said, and it's just how you put them together, like an erector set, or Legos might be the example many of us are familiar with. We are now recognizing, she said, the extraordinary integration of the genome. So what I find interesting here is that the possibilities for a future synthetic biology were grounded both in an understanding of these remarkable hereditary mechanisms of nature and also in her experience in farmers' fields in Mexico. Seeds are nothing without environments, of course, and so it's also important to consider McClintock's own institutional soil. Most of her work on maize had taken place at this laboratory, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, the same place where these other researchers had worked to accelerate evolution, and in later years where other researchers worked on inbreeding lines of maize in order to produce this high-yielding modern hybrid corn. And her work in Mexico, the Mexican context, was conducted under the auspices of the Rockefeller Foundation, which had the explicit aim of creating what they called synthetic varieties for local use. So unlike American hybrid corn, which required the constant repurchasing of new seeds from a commercial distributor, the newly created Mexican synthetic varieties, and that's what they were called, and they were first released in 1948, these could be propagated through open pollination, and farmers could save their seed for planting the next time around. So while commercial hybrids worked well in the rich soil and the economy of the Corn Belt of the United States, the story was reversed in places like Mexico and different solutions were looked for. So biological innovations have distinctive associated political economies. In many ways, it was also around 1948 that Promethean efforts to remake heredity for human ends encountered the world of the geopolitical in an even more striking fashion. Nowhere was this more true than in the Soviet Union, where genetics and geneticists suffered a rather distinctly different fate. While in the West it was the manipulation of the gene that had been a central feature of genetics for decades, manipulation of the environment, large and small, took on a special form in the Soviet Union under Stalin. On October 20th, 1948, Stalin put forth a decree known as the Great Plan for the Transformation of Nature. This sought to remake vast landscapes by planting an enormous shelter belt of forests, as it was called, covering nearly 6 million hectares. This was an effort to plant trees to block dry winds coming from Central Asia that were thought to be the cause of drought. This great plan has been called the world's largest ecological engineering project, and also the world's first state-directed effort to reverse the human-induced climate change that had been observed. It was certainly the first to have a symphony, Shostakovich's The Song of the Forests, which was written in 1949 to commemorate both it and the great gardener, Stalin. One of Stalin's favorite advisors on genetics and agriculture went so far as to advocate for the cluster planting of trees, with seeds planted closely together, as if in affirmation of the well-known truth that Soviet comrades support each other. Over 60 to 80% of all of these government belts and forests were then cluster or nest planted with these tree seedlings very close together. And 8 years later, the result was clear. Seedlings in industrial oak areas experienced a 94% death rate, costing at least ₹1 billion. Overall, only 1/3 of seedlings that had been planted by any method survived after 8 years. So the great plan for the transformation of nature was big on promise, but failed to deliver. The effects of Soviet pseudoscience on forestry were bad enough, but they were just one part of a larger Soviet approach that identified the manipulation of the environment rather than the gene as the key to the future of agriculture. In genetics, this went by the name of Lysenkoism, named after Trofim Lysenko, the peasant turned scientist who served as Stalin's advisor on these matters, and according to one historian who had taken off like a rocket into the firmament of Stalin's empire. Lysenkoism was in part a demonstration of Soviet peasant common sense as opposed to elite knowledge. And the story goes that when the distinguished geneticist Nikolai Vavilov asked Lysenko, well, how would you chemically distinguish the difference between a lentil and a pea? Lysenko responded, well, put them on your tongue. So Lysenko steadily gained power through the 30s and the 40s, but it was only in 1948 at an infamous meeting of the All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences of the Soviet Union that Lysenkoist efforts at the kind of instantaneous remaking of heredity that he had in mind became official party dogma. Denying the reality of genes as bourgeois fictions, you will never see a gene, for there is no such thing, Lysenko said. He claimed that all heredity could be molded by paying attention to human control of the environment. A simple technique called vernalization, for instance, could supposedly improve harvest by chilling and pre-adapting seeds to a harsh wintry climate, something that would obviously be helpful in the Soviet Union. But Lysenko made many other claims besides that stretch our credulity, that a pine tree could spontaneously transform some of its branches into a fir tree, that wheat could somehow become rye, that harvests would become ever more bountiful, whatever it took to make the truth of Soviet science apparent to the world. Lysenko's attacks eviscerated Soviet genetics for a generation. They delayed modern methods of agriculture, and they ultimately contributed to the starvation of tens of millions of Soviet citizens. And what were once common and Promethean dreams, both inside and outside the Soviet Union, to envision new ways to remake heredity for human ends, began to shatter under different political realities. As the sciences of heredity ran headlong into these other dimensions of geopolitics, Mahler, who had long been a contributor to Soviet fruit fly genetics, fled the USSR. In 1948, he resigned from the Soviet Academy of Sciences. But his friends and his colleagues, who newspapers had called fly lovers and man-haters, suffered more difficult fates for their hereditary heresies. In the wake of the 1948 meeting, some 3,000 scientists lost their jobs, others committed suicide, and Nikolai Vavilov and several other distinguished geneticists were executed or exiled to the gulags. Lysenkoism dominated Soviet biology into the mid-1970s. But such ideological scuffles over science also left their mark on the very concept of mutation itself. In the Soviet Union, where mutations were conceived of under manipulations of the environment, mutations then began to be conceived as directed, as purposeful, as potentially useful, and often as being visible at the level of the phenotype. You would see it in the organism in the field. In the non-Lysenkoist West, and in no small measure because of Muller's important work on these issues, mutations began to be viewed as fortuitous, as deleterious, and as key factors in a new genetic calculus of risk that was based on the careful study of laboratory organisms. Protecting our own human heredity from harm was rapidly becoming not merely a scientific question about genetics, but one that reflected larger concerns about humankind's place within an extensive technosphere. For how long would our increasingly radioactive Cold War world remain habitable, Muller wondered, and he calculated thresholds of mutational load for populations. So important frontiers in biological research, whether in the field or about the atmosphere, were never far from larger political contexts in 1948. That the Earth was humanity's one shared home was becoming increasingly evident in other ways as well. V2 rockets sent up to the lower limits of space offered new views of Earth. The clearest and most expansive photos of the curvature of the Earth, as it was described, were published in a magazine article with the caption, "So Columbus was right." And this newfound ability to see the Earth's actual curvature brought still further ideas for the transformation of Earth on a planetary scale, and even for the exporting of the seeds of terrestrial biology to other worlds. The ultimate escapist fantasy, and yet also the ultimate realization of an engineering vision of a proliferating technosphere. Older ideas of panspermia, that seeds of life were deposited on Earth from outer space, gained new currency as well in 1948, as astronomers and biologists publicly debated the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe. Following the novelist Olaf Stapledon's 1948 lecture on interplanetary man, within a short time, visions of life in space were intertwined with talk of seeding space with humanity in a new form of directed panspermia. It was also in the spring of 1948 that the newly emerging field of what was called astrobotany in Kazakhstan sought to use spectroscopy to understand the potential nature of potential Martian vegetation by comparison of spectroscopic studies of plants that were living in high altitude or subarctic environments in Kazakhstan. So studying how these plants maintained their thermal states in extreme climatic environments meant that there might be practical links between fluorescence, frost resistance, and drought hardiness in plants. This is what one Soviet researcher wrote, thereby showing the practical value of astrobotany. Even the most otherworldly dimensions, then, of the technosphere, the detection and the study of possible plants in space, could have direct agricultural relevance. Situating the emergence of life within a cosmic context was also part and parcel of investigations into the origin of life on Earth around 1948. And the same philosophical principles that could explain the origin of life in other worlds surely could apply to the origin of life here on Earth. Or at least that's what the biochemist and Lysenkoist supporter Alexander Oparin had claimed. In 1947, Oparin denounced Muller in a full-page letter to Pravda and called for his expulsion from the Soviet Academy. But these links between the earthly and the otherworldly were just as compelling for Muller as they were for Oparin. To understand the cosmic history of the gene for Muller was to understand its emergence on other planets in our galaxy. In many other worlds, he says, besides ours, living matter must coexist, and that in the star-bespattered abysses of the cosmos, there must surely dwell a myriad exotic forms. Our Earth, in turn, may be poor in life compared with what exists on some of the even more favored planets of stars and other worlds, of other places, he noted. During a celebratory lecture on changing genes in 1947, and which was attended by over 4,000 people, Muller brought the terrestrial and the extraterrestrial together. He indicated an interest not only in the possibilities for humanity, for remaking the Earth, or for adventuring on other planets, but also the biological possibilities of remolding life around us. These were wondrous potentialities. If we could find a way to put our wishes in harmony with biological possibilities, he noted, then the world of plants and animals should increasingly be ours to remold as we choose. And by 1958, Muller concluded, strange winds are now blowing in from the atom, the gene, and outer space. So understanding the emergence of the seeds of life elsewhere could help us better understand how to remake the seeds of life here on Earth. The outer possibilities involved in understanding life's cosmic extent were mirrored by these inner hereditary ones for Muller. And this last year at the Library of Congress, I found an inscription in a book that he had published of his collected scientific papers and which he had gifted to a young Carl Sagan. Muller wrote in the inscription in this book, about halfway down there, "What a triumph it will be when we can coordinate and combine our outer and inner quests." And then he says, "May we someday meet in spirit on the tundras of Mars." Is genetics elsewhere than on Earth another possible meaning of epigenetics? Lecturing under the title of Man's Responsibility for His Genetic Heritage, just a month after the launch of the first Soviet satellite, 60 years ago in October, Muller cautioned of the need for international cooperation. The world cannot afford to allow to individual countries, he said, their separate genetic Sputniks. So whether dealing with the nature of mutation and its prospects for agricultural production, or astrobotanical investigations of life on Earth and in other worlds, the scientific study of seeds of life has always been part, of course, of larger social, national, and ideological contexts. Agriculture and genetics, heredity and heresy, Earth and outer space, science and politics, time and again, we see the entangled links between seeds and their soils, between genes and their organisms, organisms and their environments, our inner and our outer quests. Direct manipulation and indirect ideologies are constantly transforming seeds and replowing the technospheric fields in which they grow. Culture and politics are interwoven in productive and provocative and sometimes problematic ways with biological innovation. They provide the seeds of possibility for new scientific understandings and for new forms of life, as well as some of their uprooting and their destruction. And what are seeds, of course, if not instantiations of a promise of life as it could be? Thank you.